focusing on operations. Thanks, Karen. I'm all for shameless promotion of authors in Canada. We need more of it, not less. And I'm sure that book is one of those available next door at the McGill bookstore, where you can also buy the famous McGill tie that Mike Babcock wore for the Olympic gold medal game. Just to put a little context, we're going to have a quick wraparound with the panel here before we do our Q&A in the half an hour that remains here. On Nick's, a little context on Nick's poll that you saw in his PowerPoint. He was in the field at the end of May last year at a time when the environment and water were nowhere in the news cycle, and there was no what we call coverage weights of water or the environment as an issue. We were at the end of the steepest economic downturn in 60 years, and the environment had fallen right off the table in terms of visibility as an issue. And yet, by a factor of three, Canadians chose water over oil and gas as our country's most important natural resource. That's a remarkable, what we call, bullet point. I've never seen a number quite like that. And then when you drill down in that and you asked, and I want to ask our panel their views on this, people's greatest concerns regarding fresh water in Canada, water pollution 40%, waste and overconsumption 22%, drinking water quality 18%, and bulk water exports, which is one of those, what I'm going to call, grassy knoll myths that keeps floating around out there, 17%. So it's not really a big number. But the others, 40, 22, and 18.5 are. And they all relate to not just governance, as Karen has pointed out, but to federalism and the Federation and the division of powers in Sections 91 and 92 of the Constitution Act. And it goes to more than that, I think, Karen, and I'll give you each an opportunity to respond. Not just Ottawa and the provinces and territories, but municipalities, which are creatures of the provinces constitutionally. So I wonder, you know, if you were going to have a First Minister's Conference on Water Management, what would be the top item on your agenda? Karen, you take it first. We'll go down the table.
Right. So you've hit on a key issue. Is this hot? Yeah. You've hit on a key issue with respect to the division of powers in the Canadian Constitution. It is both enabling and constraining, I think more constraining at this point, because it has inhibited, or the way we've interpreted it, it, with respect to resource governance, has inhibited a sensible dialogue about what they term the European Union, subsidiarity versus harmonization. So on the one hand, you strategically harmonize. That implies some degree of centralization and standardization. It makes sense for some standards to be shared and mutually decided upon. That's why probably 80 to 85% of water quality legislation and policy in the European Union today is decided in Brussels, emanates from Brussels. So you harmonize, but you also strategically delegate water management to the lowest appropriate scale of governance. That's the subsidiarity part of this harmonization subsidiarity dialectic. Not using those terms, but in similar ways, the US and Australia, other federations, have gone through similar dialogues about the best way to deal with water issues. We've been blocked from doing that in Canada, not in other sectors, not in health, maybe to some extent, but certainly with respect to resource governance. Well, what does that mean? It means we only get part of the picture. Various provinces, for example, have tried to integrate at the watershed scale, and they've dealt very well, more or less, with the frameworks for horizontal integration, but not vertical integration. And that's what we're really missing in Canada. So the first item I'd have on this First Minister's Conference would be this issue of how do we deal with not only horizontal but vertical integration, and are we really interpreting the full scope of the degree to which we can engage in a national dialogue about harmonization?
Okay. Chris?
I actually could not agree more with that, but there was a time in our history where we did some of that. Provinces received transfer payments from the federal government, and they said, you are more appropriate to deal with this, even though it's our mandate. We had municipalities in Ontario specifically that benefited from conservation authorities, which were provincial agencies. Now they're not resourced anymore, and municipalities have to pay for it, so they don't use it as often because they can't afford to use it as often as they'd like to. So we have this kind of disconnect. So I guess my side would be, the one thing I would say is we need to have the integration, that vertical and horizontal integration that Karen's talking about, but I think we just need to adequately resource a lot of the existing structures that we have. We've gutted our monitoring and data programs across the country. We've depleted our departments, whether they're federal, provincial, or municipal, when it comes to water and environment generally. I think, you know, if we staffed up, got some good expertise back in these places, we'd be more able to do the things that, that Karen is talking about.
Jim?
I'll show my age. I think we had it within our grasp in the 70s. Karen mentioned the Canada Water Act, which was passed in 1970. And it was an enabling piece of legislation. It allowed the federal government to cooperate with the provinces on river basin planning on a comprehensive scale. It allowed cooperation for data monitoring. It allowed for cooperation for research. And it was a very powerful vehicle. And a great deal of good was done during the 70s and early 80s. But then, as a result of budget reductions and so on, at a time when subsidies to the oil and gas industry were in the billions, a few tens of millions were taken out of that program that enabled this cooperation to take place. And the feds blew it all by becoming an unreliable partner with the provinces. And that legacy persists to today. And I'm only hopeful that the Canadian Council of Ministers of the Environment, and we'll hear a bit more from them later today, I think, may be a vehicle that will help to bring that back together again. I hope so.
Bob?
Well, first, I'd like to respond to what Chris and Jim have said, and really, it really talks about what Karen Backer is talking about. There have been some really dramatic changes that have escaped notice, and one of them is the extent to which environment ministries in this country have changed their purpose from environmental protection to environmental assurance. And it was a very subtle shift, which meant that they went from protecting these resources to actually finding mechanisms by which they could mitigate impacts of already approved projects. And in so doing, I work with provincial departments who have had their budgets cut by 75% in the last two decades, which is stunning in terms of failure to be able to meet duty and care obligations with respect to monitoring. And also what it does is dramatically reduce capacity within these departments, and our provincial and federal agencies are suffering dramatically from that. Finally, if I had a chance to talk to the First Ministers, one of the things that I think we really have to understand is how truly vulnerable we are to these matters that we're not addressing. And one of the things that I would like to point out is that Canada has a lot of dry areas. We don't know that living in the humid east, but this country has large, vast regions that are quite dry. And you want to avoid the vicious circle that has happened elsewhere where your allocation rights are granted, then you go to full allocation, then you cross the great divide of people competing with one another and with agriculture and with nature for water. Then you're really in trouble because you can't get water back for nature even when these needs have been properly characterized. This leads to ecological decline, normally expressed as desertification. And ecological decline leads to further climate instability, which can be tragic. And the point that I want to point out here is that, as Australia has shown, you can move along this vicious circle very quickly after you have deep and persistent drought. And as you move along that circle, you have fewer in choices and fewer options, and it gets harder and harder to go back towards sustainability, and you move toward paralysis. So we need to tell our First Ministers that only a national water policy reform will work that links provinces and sectors and agriculture and water policy in a new and exciting way. And I think that we have the models elsewhere that we can use to start us down that path.
Well, I think what you're all saying is that it's a leadership issue and that this is something that we could perhaps email across town to Mr. Ignatieff at his Thinkers Conference here this weekend in Montreal. And if I could point out an example of federal-provincial collaboration on an environmental issue, the Acid Rain Accord that we finally got with the United States was preceded by an agreement that Bob worked on between Ottawa and the provinces, the seven eastern provinces east of Saskatchewan, to reduce their sulfur dioxide emissions by 50%. which enabled Mr. Mulroney to go before the United States Congress and say, we ask nothing more than this from you, and it was leadership in federal-provincial relations that enabled that in the 1980s. Second question before we go to the audience. You're touching on implicitly fault lines of federalism here. Alberta's got the oil sands, Quebec's got water. Mr. Charest made very controversial comments at Copenhagen about the oil sands, which generated a huge blowback from Alberta, which is why we're having a debate about equalization and daycare in Canada now. How can we get this issue on the federal-provincial agenda in a way that's constructive and does not divide the provinces? Now, let's come, Karen, why don't we just take it in the same order?
Let's go in the other order.
Okay.
So I'm still trying to push daycare with...
And I didn't like being first this morning because of the time change, and I just have to admit to you, I don't normally speak before 10.
Well, it's 11:45 in Newfoundland.
So. That's right, to anyone. But I think that there's a real challenge here, and you know, we've looked abroad at why this doesn't get on the agenda in other countries, and other countries have the same federal-provincial style relationships. And researchers in the U.S. came up with this notion that this water falls under the area of domain it characterizes as a predictable surprise. Everybody knows there's a problem, and everybody knows that it's getting worse. But they also, if you're a political leader, you realize that it's a complicated, emotionally charged issue, and that political gains are uncertain, and they're likely to be long in the distant future. And there's already somebody with vested interests whispering into the politician's ears, it's okay, you don't have to do anything. And in fact, if you do, we'll cause you a lot of grief. So what you're finding is that this is a hard one to motivate leaders to overcome the types of problems federally and jurisdictionally. But we have to recognize what's happening elsewhere in the world. If you can get ahead of this, you can save yourself a tremendous amount of political grief and economic damage. And I think we've got to cultivate political leaders who will take charge of this in a committed, persistent way, and who will look at that federal-provincial thing as something that can be overcome and should be overcome before we find ourselves in a situation where we're forced to act.
Jim?
I have a naive hope about water. I think that every part of the country has serious water problems. Bob emphasizes the dryness of some parts of the West, but think of the problems of pollution and water levels in the Great Lakes St. Lawrence system, which have profound effects on the largest population centers of the country. I think that an active role on the part of the Council of Ministers of Environment and with some hopeful leadership by the federal government could get people working together on water issues, and that might create a pattern that would help overcome some of the difficult issues you've mentioned, Dean.
Okay. Chris?
Yeah, I think to build on what Jim is saying, once you can convince our politicians, and so first convince Canadians that water really is our most important resource, far more important than the oil sands, you'll start to get some turnaround. I think that's a hard job to do because while we're all environmentally engaged and we're probably very familiar with what the oil sands do to our water and to our environment in general, I think the majority of Canadians, they live in the south. They don't know much about the north. They don't know what an oil sands development looks like. And they don't think it has an impact on them. And so it's hard to turn that into votes that's going to affect our politicians. So I think the reality is that one of two things have to happen. One, you're going to have to come up with a clear and present danger from the oil sands that's going to get a lot of media attention. And that will start to get attention in Ottawa and the provinces. Or the other thing that's going to happen is we're going to see our trading partners like the U.S. and others that are going to say, you know what, we're on a different economic track and we're not going to buy that stuff anymore. And that will get our attention.
Okay. Karen, fine.
I'm going to give an example which predates me, and so I'm going to get the details wrong. But There is an interesting precedent. There's a set of issues I'll mention, but the first one I want to mention, it picks up on your point, last point, Chris. To what extent could pressure internationally result in changes domestically? Think about the whole debate about exporting hydroelectricity from Quebec to New York, this interesting alliance of the Cree, Canadian environmental groups, and U.S. groups who said, we don't want that kind of power, of hydropower. So I think there is great potential and actually growing movement to enact those sorts of pressures here domestically. I actually don't think it's the strongest mechanism. It's one short-term mechanism. I've got three other ideas. So I think we need, in response to your question, change at the provincial level. Manitoba has a Ministry of Water Stewardship, just created a few years ago. Great. We all need one. Every province, every jurisdiction. They need to get together and harmonize certain aspects of water governance. Start with drinking water standards. Why not? The CCME, a great vehicle for a pan-Canadian water strategy on water security, resourced in order to provide a forum for sharing lessons learned. We've got great examples across the country of delegated water governance. We don't effectively share them. How many people in BC know what's happening even in Alberta? Finally, I'm going to steal an idea from Ralph Pentland. All of this won't work unless we have sticks. In the US, they have sticks. They do in the EU, too. One of the major drivers for improvement of water quality in the UK over the past 20 years has been legal action by the European Union. At the European Union level, they sue member states if they don't comply with their legislation. A great stick. In the US, public trust law. If the governments don't comply with their own legislation, because they have a duty under public trust law to safeguard the public goods of which they are the stewards, someone can sue. We don't have an analogous mechanism here in Canada. I know this is completely unrealistic, but it is one of the key mechanisms that I didn't mention earlier, which enable change to be pushed forward in these jurisdictions and not in Canada.
Okay, and just quickly on the bilateral, historically, one of the reasons that the IJC, the International Joint Commission, was created a century ago was management of Great Lakes water issues, right? Yeah. Okay. Emmanuelle and her colleagues from the MISC here are going to circulate with the microphones. House of Commons rules, you can make a declaration, you can have a preamble, you can make a speech, you can ask a question, but you only get 30 seconds.
Thank you. Hi. Thanks to all the panelists. That was wonderful. I think that's
sorry, could you just state your name and affiliation, please?
I'm Celeste Cote. I'm the National Water Campaigner for Sierra Club Canada. So I generally have one foot with trying to talk to community members and do education and engagement there, and one foot trying to talk to decision makers and do education and engagement there. And one thing that folks have been asking me on a political level is, okay, we understand that we need to take action on water issues. Platforms, people are starting to think about these kinds of things. How do we sell that idea? Because for those of us in this room, we know that we need a pan-Canadian water strategy. But pan-Canadian water strategy on a political platform doesn't really get people excited. So what are some, I think, hot-button issues or ways to make this more... I'm a water nerd. I get excited about water anyway. But for those of my friends that aren't into this stuff, how do we get them excited?
Okay, let's try and move this one a little more quickly. Okay, guys? Who wants to take that?
Okay. First of all, I think that one of the ways that it works in this is making water the meaning and measure of so many other things. And I think water is an absolutely irreplaceable vehicle for getting into larger ecosystem issues, to tie into climate change, and also as the indicator of what's happening locally. And I think by charging those views, I think you can get it on the political agenda.
Anybody else want to take that?
Can I just clarify, actually? What I'm trying to say is that it's kind of on a political agenda for some folks, but how do you, because it's a complex issue,
because water is seen as such a complex issue, how do you simplify it and I don't want to say dumb it down, but be, if you're going to have a platform point, how do you, if you have 30 seconds or one point in a platform or a few points,
if you're going to do that, you have to pick the single most representative issue locally to do that with, and pick the one that allows you to address all the most diverse issues with respect to what water is and does in the place in which you live. And I think that's one way of doing it, but I'd be happy to talk to you more about it.
Emma, I think something that's beginning to attract quite a bit of attention is the backsliding of the Great Lakes. We spent a lot of money, U.S. and Canada spent over $5 billion to clean up the Great Lakes in the 80s or so, and they responded magnificently. But they're now backsliding, and we're seeing serious problems of Lake Erie going back to a eutrophic state, algal growths along the shorelines, and, of course, it's happening in Lake Winnipeg, too. And those issues really capture the people's imagination, I think. And I think if we use the things that really, as Bob says, that really affect people close to where they live, they can see the need for approaching water issues.
Emma, next one.
Hugh Whiteley, Canadian Water Resources Association, and yes, I recognize that the preamble remark I'm going to make applies.
You're only
going
to get 30 seconds, though.
Restricting water discussions to the category of resource seems to me to be a great limitation. There are three other very important dimensions: the human health dimension, the ecological environmental sustenance dimension, and, as was mentioned yesterday in passing, the very important spiritual dimension. And so I'm wondering if a way to get away from concentrating on the resource only would be, as Karen mentioned, to establish a water ministry at both the federal level and at all the provincial and territorial levels, following the Australian example. So other panelists might want to comment on that.
Great question. Who wants to take it?
I'll jump in.
Take it, Chris.
I actually think that's a great idea, with the caveat that it can't be a single-line department that becomes ghettoized within a larger institution. You have to have the linkages all over the place. I mean, this gets back to the tar sands issues, right? The challenge that we have is it's about energy production, it's about environmental and sustainability, and yet all the people within individual departments that work on those separate sections don't work together, and they don't work together with the people in the other departments. So if you can find a way of having that kind of ministry of water at both the provincial, territorial, and federal level, with all the linkages into all the appropriate line ministries that require consultation with and collaborative work with, I think that's a fantastic idea.
I'd like to just make one quick comment on that, too. I think when you're dealing with water, you have to have cross-ministry cooperation. And a real reform has to go right to the senior cabinet level with almost all ministries. But I agree completely with you, Hugh, that water ministries would work and perhaps establish a different relationship, and maybe through CCME you could do that. But I would caution you that the water departments that you could, ministries that you create, can't be subsidiary to energy. They must be the equivalent of.
On this side, hang on.
Yeah, I can hold it. Good morning. I'm Diane Katz. I'm with the Fraser Institute. I think we all recognize there's finite resources to devote to water protection, and there's been emphasis here on dealing with water in the context of climate change, but given the great uncertainties there are in terms of whether there is climate change and what's causing it, I want to ask the panel whether it's justified to perhaps focus on problems such as infrastructure, urban water infrastructure, because, you know, cities are losing 20% to 40% of their water through leaks, or sewer overflows that are flushing wastewater directly into fresh water. So whether we need to put more of our resources on those immediate, very, you know, discernible problems rather than hypothetical ones.
Yes, Karen, go ahead.
So I suppose the issue of discernible problems varies greatly depending on where in Canada you live. You know, if you live downstream of the tar sands, a discernible problem looks different than if you live in a big city, not to minimize the importance of the backlog in urban infrastructure renewal that exists in Canada. It's true, you're right, it's enormous, and the dollars have not been spent, and now we're seeing the consequences. I would caution, though, against too much emphasis on the urban issue because, again, I think we've got a handle on it. The greatest threat to drinking water in Canada exists in small and rural communities, so not in urban centers. In most big urban areas, we have some measure of secondary or tertiary treatment, but we've moved away to some degree from creating vulnerabilities for urban populations. And my personal view is if you had to prioritize somewhere, it would be with respect to groundwater-dependent communities for drinking water, small and rural areas, and resource-extractive sectors, where we use 20% of the water consumed in Canada goes to resource-extractive sectors, almost unmonitored and unregulated. So urban is important, but perhaps not everywhere the first priority.
Jim and Bob?
I really agree that we need to pay a lot of attention to our urban infrastructure, and particular leakage of water, although that may be a source of water for groundwater later. the thing that's happening is with increased intensity of frequency of heavy rain intensities, we're finding that the storm sewer systems that exist or have been put in fairly recently are inadequate to cope with the flows that are occurring. For example, in Toronto, they have had seven 20-year precipitation events over the last 20 years. And that's just one example from thousands across the country. So we have to design the storm sewer systems to accommodate the changing climate to make sure that we don't just spend a lot of money to create a system that won't work again.
Mark Cadley Carlson once told me that we were down $54 billion in the amount of money that we need to restore and maintain our already existing water infrastructure. So that's certainly a focus. But I agree with Jim, and Jim showed a photograph of the storm in Toronto in August of 2005, and that was the third 100-year event in 20 years, and it caused $400 million worth of damage in 2 hours. So what the concern is, whether people believe in climate change or not, the City of Toronto is concerned that climate change impacts can damage infrastructure faster than we can build it, and that there may be more places like New Orleans where we simply can't afford to restore after damage. So these are very serious considerations.
Well, we have at least one honorable member in the House, Francis Carpellegia. You have a question? He's not invited to Mr. Ignatieff's conference, but we're happy to have him at this one.
Well, I this is a very important conference for me. I'm very pleased to be here, and thank you for having me, Ian. I guess I'm getting a little grumpy at all the swipes at politicians, but it's okay. We're used to it. On the issue of a water ministry, I presented a motion, essentially, in the House of Commons about 3 years ago, calling on the government to create not a ministry, because I don't think we need more bureaucracy, but a Secretary of State for Water, a junior minister reporting to the Minister of the Environment, who could pull together the strands of federal responsibility on water, which you know covers about 22 ministries and agencies at the federal level alone, and who could also be the champion for water, who could do the photo ops and give the speeches and work with the provinces and work with the municipalities and work with the international actors on that as well. So the issue was raised. Unfortunately, the motion was defeated, and I won't get into the politics of it, but I really do believe that that's what we need, because otherwise we're going to get bogged down in the morass of the coordinating mechanisms, which are very important, but I don't think they can provide the leadership. I don't think this can be done by committee. I think we need a federal water champion. Thank you.
So that's your 30 seconds. Is there a question there?
No, I just do you agree?
Yeah. Okay.
We could all supply anecdotes. Thanks very much for the comment. We could all supply anecdotes about failures of coordination between different federal and provincial departments and agencies. I believe in the mid-1990s, the federal government had to assemble a Where's Water team to figure out where in the world water responsibilities were being housed in the government, much less who was championing them. So I think it's a good idea. And I think it links back to the question raised earlier about selling water as an issue. I don't think we need to convince Canadians. I think they're convinced. I don't think they need a lot more information. I think they're already worried. So this champion would have a natural constituency. So thus it is a good idea, because that champion would have a natural constituency, not to though underestimate or minimize the coordination challenges that that person would face.
Okay, this is our last question. Let's make it quick, guys.
I love that idea of a water champion, and it could take a number of different forms. I always come back to the whatever that is, whether it's a minister of state, whether you actually have a department, you have to have the integrative mechanisms. And anybody that's worked in government before knows that integration happens very well when there are budgets and there is money available to do things. As soon as you start cutting budgets, people will retreat back into their primary mandates and integration falls apart. So whatever mechanism it is that we do, we develop to have that champion and ensure the integration happens, there have to be the resources there to ensure that that integration is sustainable.
And there's 5 days left in the fiscal year to get it done.
Francis, I think that's a terrific idea. And I think we need a champion. If you'd like to do it, fly at it, and we'll be behind you.
He is doing it.
He is doing it, yes.
Well, thank you all for a great opening session. I'm going to turn it back to Bob.
It's my pleasant duty on behalf of us all to thank our panelists and to thank our moderator, and to thank you all for your excellent questions. And I think you've started off this day with a really good and useful punch. You have a 11-minute break.